I did start to like lose my grip on understanding what reality was, like what was really going on, because not only had they been showing me these horrible pictures and showing me that I had two people making statements against me, but then they also started saying, well, we found evidence in your vehicle and this and that, which in my brain, I'm like, well, I know that's not true because I didn't do anything, but they're saying they found evidence. Like, how, what the fuck is going on? Am I being framed or am I in some weird, dream or something? Like, what the fuck is happening?
Feeling lost?
Then you're in the right place.
I'm Amanda Knox.
And I'm Christopher Robinson.
And this
is False Confessions,
a Labyrinth miniseries.
That was Jason Strong. And in 1999, at the age of 24, he was brought into an interrogation room for questioning regarding the murder of an unidentified woman found in a forest preserve near North Chicago. Jason confessed to the police that he had picked up the woman, taken her to the motel where he lived, and that he and two friends had whipped her, poured molten wax on her, bashed her head in with a bottle of tequila, and then left her for dead in the forest.
Jason was charged with first-degree murder and sentenced to 46 years in prison. He served 15 until a conviction integrity unit had the woman's autopsy re-examined. Three medical experts independently verified that the woman had been dead for days before her body was found, which proved that Jason's confession could not have been true. What led him to confess in the first place?
The police didn't physically beat him to coerce that confession. They didn't have to. They had other methods at their disposal. And many of them can be grouped into what you might simply call bullying. With Jason Strong, that began long before he entered the interrogation room.
So I was a bit of a mess. I was definitely not a saint. I worked in an adult bookstore, lived in a shady ass hotel next to it. I abused drugs and alcohol. I was a very lost young person. I'd gone through a lot in my life that just led me down wrong paths. But because of that, it drew the attention of a particular police officer that ended up having a grudge against me and wanted to make me suffer. He focused on me and started coming around asking me if I knew things about drug dealers or people that were selling and doing drugs. I'd always tell him I don't know anything. And he wanted me to be a snitch. And one day when he came around asking those similar questions, and this had been after months of him harassing me, he'd see me on the road, pull me over, et cetera. And he would tell me, look, if you don't cooperate with me, I'll make your life a living hell. But that morning he knocked on my door. He's like, can I come in? I'm like, I don't want nothing to do with you, right? And he's like, this is about a murder investigation. And that scared me. So I'm like, oh, fuck, okay, what do you want to know? They were trying to identify the victim because it had been 2 weeks since they found this body. But thankfully, my boss at the time saw he was there, came over and intervened. He left and I didn't think much more of it. I thought, well, I didn't do anything. So he's just harassing me like usual. But then that night, while I was hanging out with my girlfriend and one of her friends, we'd been drinking and smoking a little weed. And I get a knock on the door and I open it up and it's a bunch of cops with guns shoved in my face. They pushed into my room, threw me down, threw handcuffs on me, and started my 15-year nightmare. And that's the thing, like when we're talking false confessions, it's not just what happens in the interrogation room. It's how the whole thing starts. That initial arrest is traumatic.
Oh my God, Jason.
It's a terrifying thing. And, my girlfriend's freaking out. That adds more chaos. You're confused with what's going on. I was under the influence, so that didn't help. And so all that builds all the way to the police station.
Jason was already exhausted by the time he arrived at the police station. They arrested him at 11 o'clock at night.
So I was already kind of going on little sleep as it was, because the night before I'd been out with my girlfriend and, I maybe got 5 hours of sleep within a 48-hour window. And then I was under the influence. So when they came and got me, I was exhausted, confused, scared, had been drinking and smoking.
This made him even more vulnerable to another common form of police pressure, inducing exhaustion.
And then when I'm in an interrogation room, it wasn't like, they came in and said, hey, can you tell us about this? And when I didn't know anything, they left me alone. No, it went on all night into the early morning hours. When you're put in that interrogation room, As an innocent person, your first thought is, well, I didn't do anything wrong, so I want to cooperate with the police. But by the time you learn that they're not your friend, it's too late. You're already in this deep well and you can't get out. You feel trapped as if there's no safety net for you whatsoever, you know, and then they just keep going at you and going at you. But I had two other cops that did the start of the interrogation. And then when they left, two other ones came in and they just kept going back and forth all through the night. And like they would leave. And then as soon as I laid my head down or anything, they'd come right back in and start on me again.
This relentlessness is a form of withholding. Withholding rest, sleep, bathroom breaks, withholding quiet, or a moment to think and collect your thoughts.
Didn't let me have medication because I was on anxiety and depression medication. Didn't let me have that. Didn't let me have access to an attorney. Didn't let me have access to a phone call until after I'd given them what they'd wanted.
And the longer they withhold these things, the greater the pressure becomes.
The average interrogation, and these metrics come both out of the UK and the US, lasts for about 30 minutes to an hour. Most interrogations up to 2 hours. The vast majority up to 4 hours. When you look at the database of wrongful convictions involving false confessions, suddenly those numbers are up in the double digits. Now they're 10, 12, 15, 20-hour interrogations. Everybody has a breaking point.
That's Saul Kassin, professor of psychology at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, who you heard from in episode one.
I mean, over time, you get tired, you get fatigued, you may be sleep deprived. Sometimes this time frame involves not sleeping through the night. You may get hungry. And importantly, people don't quite understand, we have social needs as well.
That social need was particularly strong for Marty Tankleff, whose case we'll explore more fully in a later episode.
You know, he's being interrogated about killing his parents, which he didn't do and he's been exonerated for it. At one point, he says, can I just go to the hospital and be with my family? His father was in the emergency room in a coma. Not till we're done here. He had a strong need, as strong as a need for food and sleep. They wouldn't satisfy it until we're done here. And I've seen that over and over again. The need to check in with the people in your life is powerful. I see sometimes, particularly in cases involving juveniles, where, you know, my mother doesn't know where I am. Can I call her and tell her what's going on?
Yeah. I kept asking to call my mom and they said that I couldn't until they were done.
Oh, that happened to you?
I mean, at one point, her phone was on the table and her mom was calling. Do you not know this? Like, the phone was on the table, it was ringing, and her mom was calling, wondering where she was, and they wouldn't let her answer the phone. And in fact, they had tapped her phone, and they knew that Etta was on the way to Rome to come to her rescue, and that as soon as she got there, Amanda would have that familial support.
Can you imagine the stress? Not only is your mother calling, but you're not answering. And now you're worrying about your mother and what she's thinking. And all of that accumulates and kind of bombards you to the point where you got to get out of here. You got to stop this. You got to collect your thoughts. And, you know, your case is a good example because they induced you at 1:45 and then at 5:45 a.m. into signing an Italian written confession. But as soon as the pressure of the moment was lifted, you sat down and wrote a retraction of those confessions. You needed to collect your thoughts. And when you're in the interrogation room for hours, you don't really have an opportunity to do that.
This kind of physical and social withholding is already exhausting enough. But on top of that, the police have a further form of bullying, repetition and contradiction. The accusation is repeated ad nauseum, and the suspect's protestations of innocence are contradicted ad nauseum.
An American-style confrontational interrogation brings people in, presumably vets them by some interview that can tell whether they're lying or telling the truth. They immediately launch into an accusation of guilt. And that accusation of guilt is made with confidence, with certainty. If the suspect begins to deny any involvement, they overcome those denials. They argue with those denials. They sometimes threaten against those denials.
You can see this with the case of Eddie Lowry, who in 1981 was a 22-year-old soldier stationed at Fort Riley in Kansas. He was accused and coerced into confessing to the rape of a 74-year-old woman. A key part of breaking him down was simply refusing to accept his claims of innocence for hours on end.
I kept telling him I didn't do this, and this went on for about 7 hours. I didn't get no water, I didn't get no breaks, I didn't get no food, and I'm just sitting there taking all this abuse from them, and I'm telling them I didn't commit this crime until they had me just so broken down. I had my arms folded on the desk and my forehead was on my arms, and I'm crying and I'm trying to tell them I didn't do this.
We'll return to Eddie's case later, but you can see that same pattern at play with the police who interrogated Jason Strong.
It didn't matter what I said, they would just keep going and going and going, because their training teaches them that, right? It's basically, no matter what you say in that interrogation room, it's a sign of guilt. If you're too quiet, well, it's because you're guilty. If you're too verbal, it's because you're guilty. If you're agitated, it's because you're guilty. Everything is a sign of guilt. I started getting angry, and I was cussing at them and saying, you know, fuck you, why aren't you listening to me? I didn't do anything. That was a sign of guilt. That was my violent nature coming out. Later, when I broke down and I was sobbing and crying, they said, well, that was a sign of my guilt. I was showing my regret and horror of what I had done. And it's like, nothing you say matters to them. It's all a sign of guilt because they've already got you pegged, and that's what they want.
This tactic is common because it works. Here's false confessions expert Steve Drizin, who you heard from last episode.
It's not about whether or not you did this crime. It's about why you committed this crime. And every time the suspect tries to assert their innocence, they interrupt them, or they say, we're not here to discuss your innocence. That's off the table.
That relentless pattern of interruption and contradiction serves to bully the suspect into compliance.
The interrogation becomes very repetitive because it's about accusation, denial, confrontation.
That's false confessions expert Richard Leo, professor of law and psychology at the University of San Francisco.
So they accuse the suspect of committing the crime. They expect the person to deny. They cut off their denials. They reaccuse them. They tell them why they believe the person is lying. I'm trying to be as concise as I can, but that's kind of a thumbnail structure of how interrogation works, trying to break the person down, overcome their denials, and move them to stop saying, I didn't do it, and start saying, I did do it.
But this exhaustion and endless repetition is just the beginning.
Well, and it's the threats too, you know, like you got one cop that's saying, hey, you're going to go to prison the rest of your life. You're going to be raped and brutalized and beaten. And you have all these images in your head and stuff you've seen in movies. And here are these cops trying to tell you they don't think you're innocent. And they just keep railing on you over and over. And it's like, what the fuck, man? And you just lose your mind. It's an emotional overload. It really is.
One of the things that scared me the most when I was interrogated at the age of 20 was the threat of spending 30 years in prison. The idea of that was so terrifying, I could barely comprehend it. But while one officer was screaming that threat at me, another was speaking in gentler tones, but no less coercive. Just tell us what happened and this will all be over. You can go back to Raffaele. You can call your mom. Good cop, bad cop. The carrot and the stick. You've probably seen such tactics dramatized on cop shows, and it's one thing that they get right. Because a lot of the exonerees I've met who were coerced into false confessions describe this alternation of hard and soft power.
If you don't comply with me, they're going to find you somewhere out in the alley. And nobody's going to know what happened to you.
That's Johnny Hincapier, who you met in episode 1, wrongly convicted of the subway murder in New York City.
He just kept on saying things like that. He was saying, if you don't work with me, you're going to go to prison for the rest of your life. You know, so who do you think they're going to believe, you or me?
And as with Amanda, the carrot was the promise of going home.
And he said, again, do you want to go home? Because I can have somebody drive you home immediately. He kept on saying that. So I can have somebody take you home immediately. If you memorize the story and you repeat the story to somebody else that I'm going to introduce you to, I'm going to take you home. I guarantee I'm going to take you home.
The story that Johnny memorized sent him to prison for 25 years. But the thing is, he believed he was going home after signing those statements. So did the Central Park Five. They all expected to go home after their confessions. So did I. Even when they put me in handcuffs and took me to prison, I still thought I was just a witness, and I believed the police when they told me they were taking me somewhere for my own protection. It was days later, when I was officially charged with murder, that it hit me that I was not going home anytime soon. How is it that people could confess to serious crimes like murder and yet still believe they would be released once the interrogation stopped?
Suggestions over time convey to the suspect that if they confess to one of these scenarios, that leniency will follow. And all of these scenarios are pitted against, you're a monster. You're cold and remorseless. And if you don't confess to this, I'm going to have to tell the district attorney that you don't care at all about the victim. And imagine yourself who you'd rather be when this case comes to trial. And who do you think the judge is going to feel more sensitive to? Who are they going to care more about when it comes time for you to face the music? So over time, these tactics wear down a suspect to a place of hopelessness where they just give up and they just say, I'm going to accept this explanation. Sometimes they do it because they just figure, look, I got to get out of this room. And once I get out of this room, I'll talk to my lawyer, I'll talk to my loved ones. Everybody will recognize that this confession is false. And the truth of the matter is that people don't recognize that, you know, and their goose is cooked.
That's why so many false confessors report that after they confessed, they didn't realize they were going to be arrested. They had no idea. In some cases, they thought they were going to go home. In the case I just looked at, you know, the young woman said, is this going to go on my record? And again, the courts allow it because it's not an explicit promise. I'm not saying confess and go home, but it sure as hell is implied. And any average person that reads it comes home with that conclusion.
The promise of leniency and the threat of serious consequences each become more effective the more they are used in alternation, which in Saul Kasson's words, increases the stress associated with denial while reducing the stress associated with confessions. The suspect is badgered by a two-pronged attack sure to produce psychological whiplash. You can see this in the case of Eddie Lowry, whom you heard from earlier.
He's the one telling me that he would help me, he'd, you know, get me through this, get me the help I needed. He would talk to the judge. I just come clean, and again, I'm denying this. I'm telling him I didn't commit this crime. There's nothing I can tell you. And then he would get tired, and then he walked out, and then the other detective would come in, and then he was putting his finger in my face telling me, I know you committed this crime. We're going to find you guilty of this crime. If we had the death penalty and she had died, we'd be asking the death penalty on you, and telling me what a horrible person I was, what a monster I was for committing this crime. And that I needed to come clean and confess to this crime. He was bringing up things about my sister being raped. He was bringing up stuff about my brother being killed and just stuff that was really affecting me emotionally besides being accused of this crime.
The threats gradually ratchet up over the course of the interrogation. You can see that in the case of Christopher Ochoa.
I was 22 years old. I lived in Austin, Texas at the time. I was working at a local Pizza Hut. And I was just a typical kid, just enjoying my life. I was about to enroll in college.
It was October of 1988 when a woman who worked at a Pizza Hut was assaulted during an early morning robbery. She was tied up with her bra, raped, and shot in the head.
I woke up and I had turned on the news. And there was the first coverage of this murder, this horrific crime that happened. It was a shock, a little scary, you know, because at that time, I was a prep cook at another Pizza Hut. After a week, they reopened the Pizza Hut after the crime scene investigation. One of my roommates, he was going to give me a ride home. So he's driving me home, and then he says he wants to pull over at the Pizza Hut where this crime happened. I didn't really want to. So he drove up to the Pizza Hut, said, come on, let's just go in there. We'll have a beer. I didn't feel comfortable. So I just went along with it. I went in to the Pizza Hut with him. They had placed a security guard outside the door. He ordered two beers to raise a toast to the memory of the victim. To me, I found that kind of odd.
So did whoever saw them there. For the next Friday, while Christopher Ochoa was working the morning shift at his Pizza Hut, two detectives came in looking for him.
A big white detective and a female Hispanic detective. They wanted to ask me questions about a burglary. So I was already a suspect. 22 years old, I was still trusting law enforcement. They asked me, do you mind coming to the station?
Did they say anything to you in the car?
My curiosity got the best of me because I thought it was about the murder. And it was. But obviously, they're in this little game. No, it's about a burglary. And they asked me, how come you're asking about the murder and the rape? I said, well, I'm just curious. The big white detective took me to what I know now is in the interrogation room. He walks me to this room. He closes the door. He leaves. We'll be right with you. No clocks, just that window that they have. And that detective, I didn't see him for a bit anymore. All of a sudden, here comes a Mexican-American detective, a Chicano. He busts in the door. His name's Polanco. Detective Polanco, Hector Polanco. The very first thing he told me when he walks in, do you know what they call me out in the street? I had no idea. I wasn't, you know. He says in Spanish, I am the boogeyman. They call me the boogeyman. Obviously, registered a blank stare because it didn't mean anything to me. So he walks out, and then walks the good cop, Detective Belasia. And he walks in, and he says, look, man, my partner's a hothead. You know, just tell us what you know, right? And you'll be able to go home. You know, we'll let you go home. Look, sir, if I knew, I would tell you. But I don't know anything. I don't know a damn thing about this. So he walks out, and then comes Polanco again, yelling at me again, looking at my arms, grabbing my arms, lying to me. And I didn't know what he was talking about because I didn't do anything. But he kept on yelling at me, you know who did it? If you don't tell me, you're going to get charged with a capital murder and you're going to get the death penalty. He would walk out, Malaysia would walk back in, and he says, look, all you gotta just tell us what you know. He walks out, Polanco comes in. This was a long interrogation, it was about 12, 13 hours. At some point, he walks in, he grabs my arm, taps my arm. This is where the needle's gonna go.
Oh no.
If you don't cooperate, this is where they're gonna put that the lethal injection. And I'm gonna make sure I'm there. I'm going to make sure I'm there to watch you.
The bullying, the exhaustion, the promises and threats. If these aren't enough to break a suspect, the police have an even more potent tool at their disposal. Deception.
Lies have been a regular part of police interrogations since interrogations have, you know, become critical parts of a state's case. And police officers lie with impunity. And typically the lies that are most dangerous are lies that are about evidence, right?
Steve Drissen, director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern Law.
When a suspect feels that the evidence against them is overwhelming and a law enforcement officer is telling them that it's overwhelming, even though the suspect knows that they're innocent, it creates such a sense of confusion and disorientation in the suspect that it becomes easier to manipulate them, right? You know, sometimes it's so overwhelming that the suspect actually comes to believe that they might have committed this crime. They begin to doubt their own memory.
That's what's known as an internalized false confession. It's what happened to me during my interrogation, and it's the hardest kind of false confession for most people to understand. We'll return to that phenomenon later.
So these kinds of lies are probably the cudgel that brings suspects down to a place of hopelessness very, very quickly during the course of the interrogation. They're an extremely powerful tactic in interrogations. We lionize detectives who trick suspects into confessing. You know, I'll never forget this episode of The Wire where a detective hooks up a suspect to a copy machine and he fills the paper, unbeknownst to the suspect, the paper rack with true and false and true and false. And when the suspect answers a question, the word false comes up when he presses the button on the copy machine to print out paper, and the suspect thinks it's acting like a lie detector machine and ultimately confess. And these guys are like, we do anything we need to do in order to get these suspects.
That's just scrappy police work.
That's exactly right. These detectives become heroic for solving these cases with lies. But we know that it's not necessary. And that when you do that, it increases the risk of false confessions.
Most people don't realize that it's entirely legal for the police to lie to you. You can face criminal charges for lying to the police, but police deception during interrogations was sanctioned by the Supreme Court in Frazier v. Cupp in 1969. And to this day, many police claim that lying is an essential tool of conducting investigations.
We have all been in situations where we feel like we don't have any other options. We feel cornered. Maybe we haven't had the experience of being interrogated, but we have all had the feeling of this person isn't listening to me. No matter how I say it, it's not getting through.
That's Lara Zarovsky, executive and policy director of the Washington Innocence Project.
Survival instincts kick in. You really want to make sense of it. And so one of the very clearly most common interrogation tactics that will lead someone to a false confession is changing their reality by lying about the context. So again, it's about context. The context matters.
Right.
And I have to talk about Ted Bradford when I talk about the choice to make a wrongful conviction, because his case was the one that, even though I'd been in the work for years and had actually gone to law school because of a case of wrongful conviction that involved a false confession, I was so, you know, convinced that this happens. And yet I don't think I really understood, like, truly where it landed with me that I was like, I would have done the same thing. And that was because Ted Bradford was in Yakima, Washington. He was being interrogated for a single perpetrator sexual assault that happened in the small town that he lived in. He was being interrogated and they kept telling him, we know it was you. We have the evidence from the crime scene. Your goose is cooked. There's no way you're getting out of here until you tell us, quote unquote, the truth.
Here's how Ted Bradford described it himself when testifying earlier this year in front of the Washington State Legislature in support of a bill to ban police deception during interrogations.
To begin with, when they asked me to sign a Miranda waiver, I asked them, well, do I need an attorney? And they said, probably not. We're just going to ask you a few questions. So I signed the waiver of my rights. And from there, it was just 9.5 hours of constant badgering, accusations. I was told that there was evidence at the crime scene left by the perpetrator, and that when they tested that, they said, it's going to prove that you did it, so you might as well confess. I knew I was innocent, and the only way I could see out of that situation, because believe me, that's all I wanted, was to be out of that room and out of that interrogation. So that was my light of hope there. I thought, just give them the statement, give them what they want now. They'll test that evidence that they claimed was at the crime scene, and this will all be over.
He was so worried about his job, and he was so convinced based on what they said that if he just told them he did it, that they would let him go, and that there was DNA at the crime scene. So they were going to test it and realize that they had made a mistake. And this was in 1996. So keep in mind, in 1996, DNA technology was fledgling and it was new. But even Ted knew, I mean, the first DNA exoneration was in 1989. So this had not been that long.
Yeah.
But even then, he understood, if you've got physical evidence from the crime scene, you're going to know it wasn't me because I was at work, right?
Right.
And so he made a calculated choice,
right,
based on what he believed his options and the reality of the situation to be.
Several weeks later, I found out that the testing of the crime scene evidence was inconclusive. They lied about the suspect's biological evidence being left at the scene.
And if he had been told the truth, if they had used rapport building techniques, if they had not terrified him into, and also, you know, let him sleep, given him food, if he had done all of those things, they never would have gotten the false confession that put him in prison for 11 years for something he didn't do and require him to register as a sex offender and allow the actual perpetrator to go free. They would have not been stuck on that investigative trail and frankly given up on their investigation because they got their confession. So all analysis stops there. And that isn't good for justice. It's not good for victims. It's certainly not good for Ted Bradford and his family. But at the end of the day, it completely defeats the purpose of our entire system, all because they decided to use deceptive tactics because they wanted him to confess. And he did.
In my own interrogation, the police lied to me about several things. They told me they had hard evidence that I was at my house the night of the murder. A lie. No such evidence existed. They told me I was just a witness, when I was in fact a suspect. They had been tapping my phone for days. They told me Raffaele had retracted my alibi, saying I wasn't with him the night of the murder. This was particularly destabilizing because I just couldn't imagine why he would lie about that. That's because I couldn't imagine that they had coerced him with the same lies they were telling me. And worst of all, I couldn't imagine that the police, who I was raised to trust and respect, who I was depending on for my safety in the wake of my roommate's murder while a killer was on the loose, I could not fathom that they would lie to me. All of this, compounded by the bullying, exhaustion, promises, and threats, reshaped my sense of reality and made it hard to know what was true and what wasn't, including my own memories.
I had a number of conversations with judges several years ago, and I was talking about why it's so dangerous to lie to a suspect about evidence.
False confessions expert, Saul Kasson.
And I see this all the time. You know, we have cell phone records that are pinging your phone at the crime scene at that time, which is a lie. Or you fail the polygraph, the lie detector test, which is science if it's a lie. Or we found hair in the victim's grasp and we matched it to your hair and it's a lie. I was trying to explain to these judges that is psychologically coercive. That form of deception can lead somebody to confess. And I wasn't understanding what they weren't understanding until one judge articulated it this way. She said, I just don't understand how lying breaks their will. And I took a deep breath and realized, oh, you think this is about breaking the will. This is also about loosening their grip on reality.
The polygraph test is especially problematic in this regard. First of all, it's a pseudoscientific and unreliable indicator of deception.
Rather, it measures physiological signs of arousal or stress. But polygraph examiners and many suspects believe it works. This means that examiners suffering from confirmation bias may read signs of deception that aren't there. And if a suspect believes it's a scientifically reliable tool, being told they failed the test can be deeply destabilizing. Polygraph examiners also go out of their way to convince suspects that the polygraph is infallible. Saul Kasson explains in his book, Duped, that they will even resort to trickery to do so, asking the subject to pick a card from the deck and then to lie or tell the truth in response to a question about that card. Using the con of marked cards, the examiner gets to impress the subject with an accurate true-false judgment. That makes the news that they've failed the polygraph test, often a lie itself, all the more distressing.
Looked at me and said, Mr. Lowry, my test is showing me that you're lying. I said, lying? How am I lying? I go, I told you the truth about everything. He goes, well, the test says you're lying. He goes, listen, if you tell me the truth right now, you know, admit that you did this, I'll talk to the two detectives and they'll go easy on you. And I said, look, I go, I didn't commit this crime. I don't know what you're talking about. I've told you the truth about everything and I'm innocent. And he walked out, got the two detectives. They came back in and got me and put me back into that interrogation room. And that's when things really went downhill.
Perhaps the most egregious use of the "you failed the polygraph" lie was in the wrongful conviction of Christopher Tapp in 1996. Over 60 hours of interrogation, the police staged 7 sham polygraph tests, telling Tapp that he failed each one. As Saul Kasson put it, in each instance, the objective was to bring his story more into line with the newly discovered evidence.
You lie about the evidence, and suspects get disoriented and confused, and they're not so sure anymore what happened or didn't happen. Investigators are trained that in order to bolster the accusation of guilt made with certainty and overcome the objections and denials, you need to point to the evidence you have. Let the suspect know we have evidence, and that breaks the suspect down into a state of despair. Great. If you have evidence, I have no problem with that. But here's the next step. If you don't have evidence, you're allowed to manufacture it. You're allowed to lie about it and pretend that you do. And the U.S. courts don't see a problem with that. And there's the difference. We're not just allowed in this country to confront suspects with real evidence. We're allowed to make it up. And sometimes that is particularly powerful, potent evidence. I think you're familiar, for example, of the case of Marty Tankleff, accused of killing his parents. Well, they came in and said to Marty, we just spoke with the hospital. Your father has regained consciousness. He said you did this. And Marty was aghast. Lies like that, I've seen them in cases in which the suspect was 13 and 14. You bring in a kid, you lie about the evidence repeatedly. You lie more than once. The lies are big lies, not small lies. And sometimes you even cite the person in their life they trust most. Now, stop and ask yourself this question. And that's okay? The courts think that's okay? And of course, they've been there for hours and they're under stress, so that doesn't help. And that's one of the tactics that is horrific and needs to be banned. And the good news is about 6 or 8 states now in the last 3 years have banned the presentation of false evidence to minors. Nice first step, but should only be considered a first step because that same tactic can have that same effect on adults.
Believe it or not, these forms of psychological coercion aren't just happening unofficially or because the police don't know any better. They're actually part of the manual. In the next episode of False Confessions, we'll explore the problematic gospel of interrogation practices, the Reed technique, which has influenced interrogations around the world for more than 50 years.
In the meantime, get lost with us. Find us on Blue Sky at amandanox.com.
At wisecracker.bsky.social.
On Instagram at amamanox.
At mccarbon.
You can learn more about our work and how to support it at amandaknox.com. And listen, we just need you to come clean here. We know you love Labyrinths. We know you want to leave us a 5-star review. Don't make this harder than it has to be.
False Confessions, a Labyrinths miniseries, is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. This episode was written and produced by us, along with our managing producer, Andre Sapp, and our production assistant, Charlie Darnell. Our theme music is by Josh Budo-Karp.